Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from The Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Caitlin.
Guess what?
What?
It's Rex Manning Day on the Bechdel cast. How are you going to celebrate?
I'm going to get the ugliest self-tanner I can possibly find, and I don't, is there a full music video for that? Because I want to see it.
It seems like they shot a full one, yeah.
I was kind of into, like, until like you get to know him better, I was kind of into Rex Manning's, like, sound. I know he's there for the moms, but I would show up.
What's the song? Say No More. Mon amour.
It's really good. I was like, you know, I could put that in my morning rotation, no problem.
Sure.
How are you going to be observing Rex Manning Day?
I am going to... I was going to say, remember when he punches a teenager? I was going to say, I'm going to punch a teenager, but I'm not going to do that.
Remember when the protagonist of the movie also punches a teenager? Yeah, Joe yes. punches a teenager. But they're like, no, but it's a paternal thing. You're like, well, that does make it worse, but okay.
So much happens in this movie, and yet not that much happens in this movie.
To me, the main character is Liv Tyler's crop top. And that is very important to me. The true protagonist.
Yes.
I love it. I want it. I can't pull it off. It's the Empire Records episode of the Bechdel cast.
Yes. So this is our show where we examine movies through an intersectional feminist lens using the Bechdel test simply as a jumping off point for our discussion. Jamie, can you remind me on this bright and sunny Rex Manning Day?
Rex Manning.
What the Bechdel... Next, yikes, my brain is tired. Can you remind me what the Bechdel cast? Nope,
no.
The Bechdel
test. It's our podcast about it. It's our okay. The Bechdel test is. I was like, Caitlin, wake up! You're dreaming.
Oh gosh,
everything's going great.
I ate some weed brownies and now I'm in a Guar music video.
Oh, I was like, Caitlin, you can't. You don't do that. I ate fruit and nuts this morning and I got like sometimes when I make healthy choices, I'm like, who the fuck do you think you are? I was like looking at my fruit and nuts like, oh, you're really going to make a change? Get a grip. Anyways, the Bechdel test is, and those internal monologues pass the Bechdel test.
Wow, true.
Yeah, because my rage at myself is about women. The Bechdel test is a media metric created by Alison Bechdel, sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test. Many different versions of this test, but the one that we use on the show requires that two characters of a marginalized gender with names must speak to each other about something other than a man for more than two lines of dialogue. And as you will learn in our Empire Records episode, it doesn't matter how weird or chaotic that dialogue is.
True.
So that's the Bechdel test. Mm-hmm. We're covering Empire Records today. It's been a request for quite some time. Yes. And we have an amazing guest to observe Rex Manning Day with.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. So she is a culture editor at Autostraddle. She's also written for Thrillist, Bitch Media, and Vogue magazine. She is Shelley Nicole. Welcome.
Hi. Welcome.
We were toying off, Mike, with introducing, I mean, we were all in on it, but possibly bringing you in as Shrekky Nicole and just seeing how far into the episode we could.
At the end, that is exactly what I'd like to be referred. I will change my Twitter handle if I have to. I promise you, I will.
I'd be like, Shrekky, what's your history with Empire Records?
Okay, so like Caitlin was talking about taking weed brownies in a guar video. Before you mentioned the guar video, I was just like, so that's what kind of podcast this is. I knew it all along.
Oh, well, I wish I could do weed. Every time I consume any amount of weed.
Caitlin,
what do you say?
You sound like you're in the CIA when you say stuff like that. Hello, fellow kids. Want to do some weed and listen to some guar on our Walkman?
Like on the clock at work while I'm literally supposed to be like working.
Oh, is that before or after he low-key assaults a woman by grabbing her foot and kissing her foot?
I think that was after she was just trying to do ballet mm-hmm. and mind her own business. And he kisses her feet. Yeah.
And he tries to kiss her head also.
Yeah. It's Yikes. Not a good look, Mark. No. It's not a good look.
Mark is a disaster. I'm so excited to talk about this movie, especially just like learning about the production of this movie is so wild.
Yeah.
And some of the result of that is you just get like bizarro disembodied shots like that you're like, what is happening?
Yeah.
What is the takeaway? And sometimes they're like, that was just kind of a vibes-based shot that we chose.
We just kind of felt like doing it, and it's 1996, so we're going to do it.
Let's party.
Let's party.
The narrative trajectory in this movie is so hard to track and fall. I was getting so much whiplash.
I got a nosebleed. It was wild.
I'll save it. But okay. Shelley. I'm sorry. Shrekky.
Shrekky. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell us about your history, your relationship with Empire Records.
It literally started with Liv Tyler's crop top. And I promise. So when you said that, I was like, yeah, that's it. I watched this movie in middle school. I found it when I was in Blockbuster. I used to go to Blockbuster with my dad. Sorry. I used to force my father to take me to Blockbuster every Friday. And I would always spend like an insane amount of time like trying to pick out one video. Mm-hmm. And it was to the point where he would eventually start waiting in the car. And then I would bang on the Blockbuster window and be like, I'm ready to check out. Like, that's how long it would take me to, like, pick a movie. Mm-hmm. But I found this movie. I go through still, like, spurts of, like, I only want to watch movies about this specific subject. And at that time, I was obsessed with schoolgirls. And to me, that meant that anybody wearing a plaid skirt was clearly a schoolgirl, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's incorrect. But I saw this movie, like, on one of the shelves. And I grabbed it because of her crop top and because of the skirt. But also, I grabbed it because I recognized her from, and this was in like 2000 when I saw it, right? Mm-hmm. I recognized her from the Aerosmith video as the other girl who was with Cher. Because I just
from
knew.
Clueless.
Yeah, I just knew Alicia Silverstone as Cher. Right. And I had never really seen her in anything else. But that video is also kind of a queer route for me. So I saw that and I was just like, so if she's in this, I don't know, maybe Cher might show up, but also maybe it'll be a little gay. I obviously wasn't using the word gay at that time in my life, but I thought maybe I would get a crossover. And I saw it, I rented it, and then I proceeded to rent it like maybe every week for the next like 2 months instead of just asking to fucking buy a movie.
You like sunk $50 into the Empire Records
absolutely.
Industrial complex. They needed the money. They lost a lot of money.
Oh, they absolutely lost a lot of fucking cash, but I made up for it at least within 2 months of Blockbuster video fees. And I rented it over and over. I watched it and I just loved it because at the time I was trying to insert myself into movies. I've always loved films and stuff like that. But at that time in my life, I was trying to like insert myself in some way into that world of whatever movie I was watching, specifically teen films. And I have an obsession still to this day with movies that take place in one day because it's easier for me to put myself inside of that world. If it's just one day, like, what would I wear? Which one of these characters would I be friends with? So, like, in Ferris Bueller, 200 Cigarettes, The Breakfast Club, Mallrats, all those movies, one day. And same with Empire Records. And then I just got obsessed with the storyline. And then I was, like, 13 or something when I tried to, like, go and work at this record store in Ferndale, Michigan. I'm from Detroit. And they were, like, you're 13. And I was like, yeah, but I've been watching this fucking movie, man. And I like really want to work at a record store. And they were like, you're 13. You can't work here.
So you were like the Warren.
Yeah,
who I was just absolutely like... Warren. And Warren is a wild character, but he's probably like my second favorite character in the movie. But that's my connection with it. And I love it to this day.
Wow.
And then you wrote a wonderful piece on the film in which you discuss your connection with it and the friendship between Gina and Corey. And yeah, we'll
very excited to get into that.
We'll talk about that. But yeah, well, we're so excited to discuss further. Jamie, what's your relationship with this movie?
No history with this movie. I had not seen it before, which I don't know. I guess I'm having kind of a tricky time knowing. I'm like, how popular is this movie? I know that it was like a flop on release and then it has become kind of a cult classic, but I don't know how many people I know have seen this movie, if I'm unusual for having not seen it. There are so many famous people in it also. So I hadn't seen this movie. I got such intense whiplash watching it, but there were parts I really enjoyed and learning about. I think I maybe liked learning about the production of this movie even more than I liked the movie itself, because it's just such a wild story. And once you know, like, basically for listeners who are not familiar with it, it's this movie was just like hacked to death by studio executives. It was originally 40 minutes longer. I guess they cut three major characters. I have some guesses as to what they are. That Lady Jane, I feel like, had to have had something else. Like, you can just see, like, there was a really, really, like, good script at some point, and then they just cut out whole chunks of it. So then you get stuff like, Liv Tyler's addicted to pills. And it's like, there's only 10 minutes left in the movie. What are you talking about? etc. I just thought it was a chaotic, weird, wild ride. I'm very excited to talk about it. Caitlin, what's your history with Empire Records?
I also had no history. I thought I had seen this movie. I thought this was one of those movies that I like watched in college because I was like, I have to watch all these, you know, cult classics and all this stuff. And I think I had just seen a bunch of similar movies, such as Reality Bites, Mallrats, High Fidelity, Dazed and Confused, maybe. Like, I'd seen all those and I just thought,
this is a lot of Renee Zellweger movies, really.
Yeah.
But then I started watching the movie and none of it was familiar. And I realized I, in fact, had never seen it. So, I don't want to be the villain of the episode, but I do
not to be the villain of the episode.
Like the movie, especially from like a screenwriting standpoint. And we'll talk about how the story that unfolds and is kind of like muddled and random and like whiplashy as it often gets. It's like not the fault of the screenwriter, because like you said, Jamie, there's a lot of studio notes and changes and also like post-production changes that made the, from a screenwriting point of view, the story really.
Right, which Shelley, you like laid out really clearly in your piece as well, of just like how much was hacked out of this.
A lot of stuff went through it, because I got to talk to Carol Heikkinen.
That's so cool.
So I got to talk to like the writer and everything about it, and it was really cool. And she was telling me just like, and we'll get into it obviously, but like just how hacked up the movie ended up being, like for the audience when it actually came out versus the cult classic when like maybe 10 years later when people like me found it and like still loved it. But it went through a lot. It went through a lot.
Yeah. So just like watching the movie with having no nostalgia attached to it, having never seen it, watching it for the first time in 2022 as a person in my mid-30s, I don't have quite the same attachment to it.
Caitlin was rooting for Mitch.
I was rooting for Mitch. I was like, yeah, Music Town.
She's like, make it a bidet store again. Music sucks.
Tower Records, me. That's what I want. Capitalism, give it to me.
Yes.
I do love, I mean, that 90s convention where they're like, capitalism is one guy.
Exactly. Like, yup. Capitalism is just this one person in 1996, and he wants to sell toilets.
And he's not that bad. And you're like, what is happening? I love it.
So the movie isn't necessarily for me, but there's a lot to talk about. So I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah.
I guess I will attempt to recap the movie.
Oh, good luck.
I think will be the greatest challenge of my career.
Shelley, jump in whenever you know the text.
I refuse because I've been like listening and I've been being like, okay, during the recap, shut the fuck up. And I will probably chime in 2 to 7 times. But like, other than that, I don't think this is going to be a very long recap. So there's also that.
It's longer than you think. Oh my gosh. But
there's all these things that happened. And then it's like, well, it's never referenced again. But it did technically happen.
It did kind of happen. Yeah. So I'll jump in occasionally.
Okay.
Cool. All right. Here we go. So we meet Lucas, played by Rory Cochran. He is one of the employees of Empire Records, which is an indie record store in, we're not sure what part of the country. He briefly chats with his colleague Gina, played by Renee Zellweger, about how tonight is a big night for him because their boss, Joe, is trusting Lucas to lock up, which means counting the money, dropping it in a safe, all that stuff. And as he's doing that, Lucas notices some paperwork about a corporate buyout of Empire Records by this conglomerate, Music Town.
This is all like narrated by Lucas in this opening sequence, which is, it's just one of the many bizarre things this movie does that makes me laugh, that kind of comes and goes. And there's not really any rules about it, where he's like narrating it like he's fucking Hunter S. Thompson. He's like, oh no, we're being bought out. And then he's like, and sometimes I'm like, is he talking to camera? And then sometimes people are talking to camera, but then most of the time they're not. Sometimes they're just talking to themselves. It's so confusing.
Right. It doesn't happen enough to make it a consistent motif, but it does happen often enough that you notice it. So
I kind of wish it happened more, because it's whenever I do like when someone turns to camera, I'm like, that's such a goofy choice and I always like it.
It's my favorite thing.
Right.
And it's even more of a thing when it's unnecessary and then inconsistent. Like, it's even better.
Right. If it's a mess, I want more of it.
So anyway, clearly the store is in financial trouble because of this like corporate buyout that's about to happen. So Lucas gets the idea to take the money that they earned that day, I think, or I don't know if it's like all the money in the safe. I'm not sure, but it's $9,000. Take it to Atlantic City and gamble with it to try to earn enough to save the store.
Capitalism.
Unfortunately, Lucas loses all of the money and then heads out of town the next morning on his motorcycle. But don't worry, he'll be right back. But the boss, Joe, comes into the store. He can't find the money. He's freaking out. Meanwhile, we meet the other staff as they come in to work that day. AJ, played by Johnny Whitworth. Mark, played by Ethan Embry. AJ is like this artsy, sensitive type. Mark is like a stoner doofus. We also meet Corey, played by Liv Tyler. She's like, Little Miss Perfect, I'm going to go to Harvard.
And she's wearing that crop top.
Yes.
She is.
Just wanted to shout it out. It's important.
Feminist icon, blue crop top sweater. And then we see Gina again. Again, that's Renee Zellweger. She's like the slutty one, quote unquote. They all come into work. They are all teenagers, question mark? We're not sure how old these people are, yeah, really, except for Liv Tyler, who seems to be a senior in high school.
Right. I feel like they're like between 18 and like 23, 4?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too, because it's really only clear that it's her, because she's going to Harvard.
Right.
Yeah. Other than that, I think everyone's like under 25. Mm-hmm. I think. Yeah.
Right. Because it's like implied that some of them are like working at Empire Records instead of going to college or something.
Yeah.
Don't worry. There's not going to be a talk about loans or any people in movies don't have college loans. It's just not a thing.
No.
Right.
But they're just like, I don't know. Like, do I want to keep chilling out here or do I want to go to art school in Boston? I'm like, right, honestly, as someone who did that, don't go to art school in Boston. Keep your record store job. You're wasting your fucking money and your life. Okay? Don't do it.
Wow.
0 out of 10. Shots would not fired. Do again. In so much debt for no fucking reason. Didn't learn a single thing.
Yeah. No, I, as someone who went to screenwriting school and got a screenwriting master's degree.
I mean, you use it every week, Caitlin.
I use it every single week.
You use it every single week.
Can I tell you how much I wanted you to say that? Not that you bring it up a lot, you know, no bigs.
I would never bring it up.
You would never. You're not that kind of person. But I was so excited and hoping that you would. Just occasionally. Just a little bit.
There it is.
And it's true. It's all true.
It's all true. Okay. So we meet the staff. And also that day is Rex Manning Day at the store. So a pop star named Rex Manning, who kind of had his heyday in the 80s, it seems, is coming into the store to sign autographs and promote his new album.
I think they're mapping him on like Barry Manilow. I was trying to figure, is it Barry Manilow? Okay. Because I was like, visually, he's giving Barry Manilow. And
right.
I do love that he's so furious that all of his like listeners are his age. I'm like, what did you expect, sir? Leave, these mothers are paying your rent. Show some respect.
I have a whole thing about his fan base in the movie and like what that telegraphs to the audience. We'll get there.
I mean, that's like classic Gen X movie, like people over 30 should die. Like
very.
Oh, yeah. God, the most annoying generation. Sorry to our listeners who are a member of it. I mean, whatever. Our generation takes plenty of shit. But
I mean, maybe every generation is bad. Just putting it out
there. Yeah, wipe out the species. Done.
We've had our chance and we blew it as humans.
Whatever. Millennials, we have ugly pants. Like, it's fine. Whatever.
All right.
Our generation never figured out pants, and I stand by that. I really just don't. I think we tried like several times to like get down pants that would work on more than one body type conceptually, and we just like kept fumbling it in new and interesting ways.
Excuse me, my boot cut flare legs from American Eagle were awesome.
No.
I'm wearing skinny jeans that I glued to my body, and I think that they actually look and feel really comfortable. You're just like, all right. We fucked up pants.
Yeah. Okay, so we established that it's Rex Manning Day. Corey wants to lose her virginity to Rex Manning while he's there. We also learn that AJ is secretly in love with Corey, and today is the day that he plans to tell her. We meet another employee who comes in, Deborah, played by Robin Tooney. She comes in, she shaves her head, she has a bandage on her wrist, which some of the other staff notices. She also has a pretty antagonistic relationship with many other members of the staff, especially Corey and Gina.
Yeah, she's a guy's gal. No, I feel that's one of the more frustrating things about this movie, where it's like there's clearly was so much more to Deb's story or Deborah's story at one point. And it just feels so obvious that so much of it went away. And it's like, I want this context of why you struggle to connect with other women, because I feel like it would have mm-hmm. landed so much better when she's, it seems like she has issues with her mom.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, there was a story in there, but we didn't get to see it.
Nope.
Anyways.
Then Lucas shows back up, the guy who had taken the $9,000 at the beginning of the movie. Joe is like, where's my money? And Lucas tells Joe that it is recirculating in Atlantic City, which is very funny. Then Joe is like, well, okay, well, what the hell? And he considers calling the cops and pressing charges against Lucas, but he does not do that.
No, because fathers and sons.
Right.
Can't do that.
And then Joe explains that he had gotten together enough money to buy the store from the owner, this guy, Mitch.
AKA Mr. Capitalism.
Mr. Capitalism. And this would have allowed Joe to stop Mitch from selling the store to Music Town. But now he can't do that because this $9,000 is gone, because apparently it costs only $9,000 to buy a store.
I'm like, where do they live?
And that's the thing, especially because he comes back so fast. Like, even if he gets back the next day, like, where are they? But then also they're like on this like really pretty seaside, because when Mark goes out to take a break, you see that. And then when they go pick up Corey, you see all that. I don't know. But it only costs $9,000 to save a record store in 1996. So not to save, but to buy.
Right. That has like beachfront property.
Yeah. And three floors.
Uh-huh. Like, right.
So much downtown. Square footage.
So much square footage. It's downtown. There's three floors. It's beachfront property. It has a beautiful smoke break section and a place for staff to live, because Burkle lives back there.
Oh, wait. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah. He like comes from back. And I don't know. It's a very good live work space for $9,000. So
that is so funny. Gen X, don't yell at me. I love you guys. It's all good. But like, I'm just like, what are you guys so upset about? It costs $9,000 to have a three-floor house downtown. Like, enjoy it while it lasts, bitch. Like, what are you so mad about? Anyways.
I don't know, man.
It's all... Man, the man sucks. The man. The man. Mr. Capitalism Mr. is Capitalism. Peeing on my floor. Like, all right.
Yeah. Okay, so because Lucas lost this $9,000, Joe has no choice but to transition the store into a Music Town very soon, which means that they would have to, again, answer to the man. Mm-hmm. They'd lose the cool indie vibe of the store. They'd have to follow all these strict rules. So no one who works at Empire Records is happy about this.
Which is true. I mean, I like that, like, this is, like, all based on Tower Records and, like, that whole story and, like, saving indie. Like, that end of stuff, I'm like, oh, that's, like, very compelling and cool. And
sure.
Places like that truly do not exist anymore. Like, Tower Records, I think, went out of business in, like, 2005 or something.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of working at, like, an indie alt comedy venue, which I did for several years.
Yeah.
And, like, the vibe and the camaraderie with your fellow staff, and that was my favorite aspect of the movie. Mm-hmm. But so I get that.
Yeah.
So what's the next scene that happens? Because it's truly just like, and then another scene happens.
But, it's so hard to keep track of.
But I think it's that Lucas stops a shoplifter, Warren, who is trying to steal a bunch of CDs. The staff shames Warren, and then they make him stick around just sitting on a couch while they wait for the cops to show up.
I was just like, there is this weird, like, no exit vibe to that room. Like, it's just kind of like Empire Records purgatory, where it's like, if you're in trouble, you just have to sit in this room, and you could leave at any time, but for whatever reason, you don't.
You don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Joe is like, Lucas, you stole $9,000 from me. Well, gosh darn it, you better sit on this couch, and don't you dare get up from that couch. And then Lucas just stays on the couch for like the first half of the movie.
Yeah.
Well, daddy said so.
Okay. So people are lining up for Rex Manning Day. Rex Manning shows up with someone who might be his assistant. It might be his publicist. We're not really sure what Jane's job is.
I'm convinced this is one of the characters that got super, super cut down because she seems like she belongs there.
Yeah. And it's Debbie Mazur, too, which is just fucking like incredible, who I'd like to nominate for the Eyebrow Hall of Fame to this day.
Yes.
Like, if you see her on Younger, where she plays, like, I don't know, the coolest dyke in the world. The eyebrows are still, like, I'm, like, doing a rewatch of Younger right now. But she has, like, incredible eyebrows. But also in 1996, she had beautiful 1996 eyebrows.
She did. Yeah, she's, it took me until, like, her second appearance in Empire Records to be like, oh, she's from Younger.
Yeah.
Younger, underrated, baby.
Underrated show.
She's so great. Yeah, that character, like, again, I mean, so many characters are full chaos, but her in particular, where she's like there and then she has like a scene and then she's like, I quit. But she says, I quit to Joe. And I'm like, do you work for him? And then later she comes back and she's like, okay, Joe, I want to go on a date with you. And I was like, how old are any of these characters? I don't understand. How do they know each other? I thought that they were meeting at the beginning of that scene.
I thought so too, yeah.
But apparently,
I don't know.
Empire Records is going to Empire Records in that I don't know what the fuck is happening at any given point in the movie.
Oh gosh. Okay, so Rex starts signing autographs. He seems very resentful that his fan base is largely middle-aged women. Mostly everyone who works at Empire Records thinks that Rex Manning sucks, and Jane is like, oh yeah, I guess he does suck. I quit working for him, but I'm going to tell Joe and not Rex.
Even tell someone unrelated.
Then another employee shows up, Burko. He and Deborah seem to have some history. There's also been other scenes, you know, scattered throughout the movie of things like staff putting on music and dancing around the store, quick conversations between various characters to establish more of their like relationship dynamic, other random things here and there.
Those scenes are fun. I love the concept of veto. That was my like one of my favorite. I was like, oh, that is such a record store like thing.
It is so cool and definitely something I tried to like implement in drama club and in high school.
Nice.
Except no one fucking knew what I was talking about, so I just like had to eat my bag of Skittles and I was like, it's fine. Just because you guys don't know film doesn't mean that has anything to do with me, but whatever.
They're like, what is Shrekie talking about?
Shrekie, please sit down. And I was just like, you know what? In about 10 years, I'm going to have my day about this movie, so it'll be fine.
Oh my God.
But also, quick side note, the guy who played Burko was Liv Tyler's stepdad at the time.
Yes.
Oh.
Coyote Shivers is his name.
Yeah.
And
of course, okay, first of all, of course Liv Tyler has a stepdad named Coyote Shivers. I guess I've never been less shocked in my life. Liv Tyler's had such a wild life.
I was gonna say, yeah, if you ever have an opportunity and you just want to go for a quick ride on Wikipedia, go to Liv Tyler's Wikipedia page.
Ooh.
It's a roller coaster.
Sometimes it's like, sometimes I get annoyed at nepotism stuff, and then you read Liv Tyler's Wikipedia page and it's like, she deserves everything she has because she's been through enough. There is so much weirdness in that poor woman's life. And if you want a real journey of the spirit, watch Liv Tyler's Architectural Digest video, because it's like, she's a weird lady.
Okay, this is taking, I love a good kismet moment. Sorry, Caitlin.
No,
just
please.
Like, can you all shut, this is my seventh and final interruption, by the way.
Don't limit yourself.
But I just was making my partner watch Architectural Digest videos. We've been watching them all morning, and it started because I was like, let's watch Liv Tyler's. Like, and we've been watching
it
all
weird?
Day. It's my favorite one because I want it. I want it. All right, sorry. Back to the insane plot that is Empire Records. I don't know where we are in it, but...
I don't know either.
Liv Tyler and Dakota Johnson, two weird nepotisms, giving... the Architectural Digest tours of a lifetime. You're just like, oh, no one's ever told you that you're weird before because you're so beautiful and you grew up with so much money, but you're being so weird right now, Liv Tyler.
But you're fucking weird, man. Like, yeah.
Oh, I love it.
Okay. So the next thing that happens is Mitch, the guy who owns Empire Records, shows up to pick up yesterday's money. Joe decides not to rat Lucas out for stealing it, and instead Joe stuffs the like money pouch thing full of scrap paper to make it seem like it's full of cash. And then he gives that to Mitch. Mm-hmm. Then Corey insists on fixing lunch for Rex Manning because that's going to be her opportunity to seduce him, which she tries to do. And he's basically like, okay, well, you can suck my dick. And then she realizes...
She's like, oh no!
Yeah, she feels humiliated. She runs up to the roof where she bumps into AJ, who finally professes his love for her.
Chaos.
But she is distraught and she wants to be alone. So he leaves feeling very rejected. Mm-hmm. Then Gina tries to comfort Corey about this Rex Manning thing, but Corey ends up aggressively slut-shaming Gina. So then Gina decides to seduce Rex Manning and she has sex with him. While that's going on, Corey goes up to AJ and says, I'm sorry I freaked out before, but I just don't think of you like that. You're my best friend. And I'm like, that's news to me because I thought your best friend was Gina or what? Like, are you friends at all? We haven't seen you talk on screen yet.
I feel like the movie was like, and she doesn't even know I exist. But then she's like, you're my best friend. I was like, oh, right. She doesn't.
Like, she knows you exist. She just wants nothing to do with you.
Right.
Not very Manaloian enough for her, apparently, I guess. But yeah.
I know. And then it was like, she at the end, I mean, whatever, things are about to get so out of control, but she's like, you're such a talented artist. And I was like, have we seen him do any art? Do we know what his art looks like? What is he any good?
He glued some quarters to the floor and called that art. We do see him like sketching some things here and there, and he does seem to be a pretty talented artist, so I'll allow it.
Okay,
but
good for him.
That scene did remind me of, what is it when like Steve Zahncat from Stuart Little or someone's like, you're my best friend.
Snowball, you're my best friend.
And I'm like, Steve Zahn's
greatest role. Move over everything he's ever done. Steve Zahn as Cat from Stuart Little is so funny. Snowball, you're my best friend. Oh my God. It's so iconic. Funny. He could have been in this movie. He would have fit into this world. Alfred Molina could have played Joe.
Oh yeah,
very
true.
Well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because what's his name?
Joe is played by Anthony LaPaglia.
LaPaglia?
Yeah.
LaPaglia?
Not sure.
I did not know who this man was, but I did figure out halfway through that he is definitely Australian because he kept forgetting that his character wasn't Australian. Where he just like, it was a little thing when he was like, I forget. He's like talking to Lucas about something and he's like, you give the money back. You're like, whoa, wait, hold on. Where are we?
Oh my gosh. I kept being like, I know that's not Bill Pullman, but is it Bill Pullman?
Yeah, big Bill Pullman wasn't available vibes. I mean,
yes.
Okay, so Corey has told AJ she thinks of him as her best friend, and that's why she's not interested in him romantically. And he's like, that's bullshit. And he storms off. And then we see Corey take a pill, which I think is the first time we've seen her do that. The implication being that she is like dealing with addiction or, you know, drug abuse issues.
Something.
So then there's a scene where the entire store starts dancing to Rex Manning's song while Rex Manning and Gina are having sex in another room. But then Joe comes down into the store and he's like, well, enjoy this while you can, because this time next week, this is going to be a music town.
He just like runs downstairs and is like, steaks! And you're like, oh my God, what? There's enough stakes. We need to like finish a storyline. Don't start another one.
And this is when he gets really angry at Lucas and punches him.
Father's sons. He beats him up.
From a screenwriting standpoint, this movie, the inciting incident happens like 3 minutes into the movie, which it's more standard for that to be like 15 minutes into a feature-length film, so it happens right away before there's any exposition, before we know anything about anyone. We get the inciting incident. Then there's a full, I would say, 60 to 70 minutes of after this compelling conflict being established of like, we have to save the store, but oh no, the money is lost. What do we do to recoup that money and save the store? That conflict basically goes away for like 60 to 70 minutes. And then at the very end, which we're getting to soon.
He runs downstairs. He's like, remember the movie? And I was like, no, I don't. But I'm having so much fun being confused.
Okay, so but before we get to the very end, so Joe assaults Lucas, but their fight quickly blows over. And then everyone finds out that Gina is having sex with Rex Manning, including Corey, who feels especially betrayed. So then AJ attacks Rex Manning, and then AJ gets punched, another teenager or like young person getting punched by a full adult man. Then they kick Rex out of the store. Uh-huh. Gina and Corey get into a screaming match. Gina outs Corey's drug abuse. Corey starts trashing the store, but then her coworkers stop her. She calms down, and then Deborah provides some emotional support to Corey. They have a nice moment together. Then several random scenes where we see Mark eating weed brownies and fantasizing about being in a Guar music video.
Out of nowhere. It almost just feels like sometimes this movie just does stuff where I feel like they're like, so that was pretty heavy, right? Here's a little palate cleanser. Mm-hmm.
And I remember watching that the first time, and I actually, every time I rented it, and honestly still when I watch it to this day, I fast forward through that scene. Now it's a little bit more blended as like, I guess now that I do like culture writing and critiquing of films and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But honestly, most of it is just because I hate it. It makes no sense. It doesn't need to be there. Mm-hmm. And I hate every moment of that. See, it's the worst
shot
out of everything fired. They cut. Out of everything that's on the cutting room floor.
That make the final cut.
This movie. They were like, now that stays. Don't you touch it. And I was like, okay, I guess.
Well, probably because they like paid Guar.
Oh yeah, I guess.
that's it.
And then they're like, well, we can't just have wasted that money. So
I bet that is it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a mess. I'm laughing, but what a mess.
So then Jane comes back. She asks Joe out for dinner, and he's like, sounds great. Then the staff has a mock funeral for Deborah, during which everyone, you know, divulges some personal things. They bond with each other. And this is also when Gina shows back up and she and Corey make up.
I love a good plot resolution via well-timed eavesdrop where she just happens to walk in the room and Liv Tyler's like, I miss Gina. I love her so much. She's the woman I can never be. And then Gina's like, no. And then Gina says what her stakes were the whole time, apparently, where she walks in. She's like, I don't want to be like my mother. And you're like, who's your mother? And she's like, I want to be a singer. And I was like, you do? And then one scene later, she's a singer. And we're like, good for her, I guess. Like,
yeah. Awesome. So then Warren, the kid who had tried to shoplift from the store, comes back with a gun and starts shooting the store up, but it's okay because they're blanks. It turns out he just wanted to work at the record store the whole time.
What is happening? Like, which is like the most white teenager with a gun thing ever too. Yes. To just have it be like, oh, he was just having a bad day, it's all good, let's give him a job at the record store and that'll help. You're just like, no, don't do that.
It's mind-boggling. But yeah, he gets taken away by the cops again, sort of, but they're just like, well, the gun was filled with blanks and he's a minor, so we can't really do anything. And then in the next scene, he's back at the store working.
And also drinking, too.
And like, drinking. Yes. Even though he's like 15 or something.
Yeah.
He's real little. Like, I just don't know what was happening. Like, there did reach a point where I was just like, my brain is smooth. Like, anything could happen. And so when it goes to like, she's on pills, the store is going to close down. I love you. I don't want to be like my mom. We're doing a fake funeral. now someone's shooting up the store. You're just like, uh-huh. Like, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Like, I guess.
Awesome. What a weird day.
That was me watching it. I was like, yeah, okay, cool. Like when I first saw it, I was like, there's tracks. I'll do it. Yeah. I want to go work at a record store, actually. So Warren could. He's 13, apparently. So why can't I? Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Who can't get a job at this place?
And you'll never get fired despite all of the really wild things.
Because Joe needs to be daddy.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so Warren coming back with a gun actually becomes plot relevant because then news anchors show up to report on the story. So then Mark jumps into the newscast to promote a fundraiser event that the store is going to hold that night, which I guess Mark just decided, oh, let's do a fundraiser. So they put it together. A bunch of people show up. They have a big party. Gina, Burko, and some other guy play live music. Everyone's dancing. They're drinking. They raise a bunch of money. And then Mitch, the owner, shows up again. And he's like, what is going on? And then Joe takes the money they raised and buys the store from Mitch for, again, ballpark of $9,000.
A solid maybe $274. I don't know. Yeah. Because there is not $9,000 in that.
In that, like, bucket thing. Yeah.
There's right. No way. There's no way.
Maybe a grand tops.
Maybe.
But he buys the store from Mitch nonetheless. And so everyone is celebrating. Corey goes to AJ and screams at him and pushes him and hits him, telling him, you're so talented and you need to go to art school. And he's like, okay, I'll go to art school and I'm going to go in Boston so I can be near you when you're at Harvard. And she's like, awesome. And then they kiss.
And she goes, really? And then they kiss. And you're like, okay. I forgot that they knew each other.
And then the movie ends with everyone dancing on the roof,
which is fun.
So that's the story. Let's take a quick break and we will come back to discuss.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back.
Okay.
Shelly. Yeah, Shelly, kick us off. What do you want to talk about? Because I'm like, bleh.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, as I watch this movie, like I watched this with completely different eyes at first. And that's why when I talk about the movie, I know every single one of its faults that it has. Like, don't get me wrong. Totally. But there are certain movies that I'm not excusing some of them. A lot of the faults on this, I am like, it's fine. I don't care. It's perfect. Right. But other ones, I am like, ugh, what? Like, you know, with like Corey and Rex Manning and all that kind of stuff. But as chaotic as it is, I think it, for me, I love it because, again, it's one day and it makes so much sense to me up here that even the cut of it, so much can happen in a day. Like, if we were to cut up our own one day, my Friday, like we were talking about all the craziness that I had with like breaking my computer, and then I could all this stuff. It's a bunch of smash cuts. And this film is a bunch of, essentially, a bunch of smash cuts of stories with a really good soundtrack. And a lot of it can be excused, but other ones, I just kind of live in that film world when I watch it, and I'm like, everything's fine. That one gif, that little cat or whatever sitting with the flames behind him, that's me watching this movie, and I'm like, it's fine. It's fine.
Totally. And I like, so we've been dunking on the like plot of the movie pretty hard throughout the recap and stuff, but at its core, it's a movie about like a ragtag group of misfits who come together. They found a community at this store. They have fairly interesting relationship dynamics among them. And that's a very relatable story for many, many people.
Yeah.
And that's the reason this movie has developed such a cult following. It's, you know, it really speaks to anyone who might feel like an oddball, or anyone who is drawn to the idea of a chosen family.
Exactly. Right.
You know, stuff like that. So I totally get that. I enjoy that aspect of the movie. And then there's also like the anti-corporate, we have to maintain the integrity of this cool indie alt space, you know, screw the man, down with the establishment, which in the form that it takes in this movie is a very like 90s Gen X, like,
that's exactly it.
Version
very that
of like, you know, as long as I can work in this indie record store without the man breathing down my neck, I don't really care what else is going on in the world. I don't have time for more pressing social issues.
Yeah,
I just want to fucking listen to Guns N' Roses, man,
and Gwar.
Right.
And I just want to eat Skittles and burn CDs. Right. And I just want to live on this couch and carry it around with me. And I don't care about anything else that's happening in the world. But the whole, my whole world is this store, this 9 to 5 that I, or wait, open till midnight. Sorry. Empire Records, open till midnight. Can I tell you how many times I answered my house phone like that until my dad was like, we're done. We're finished. We're not doing this anymore. Also, I would answer my phone, hello, Fawlty Towers. Any show that had a pickup, I was just like,
nice.
Yeah. Weird time in the household with me. Anyway. But yeah, I think it was just like so 90s based. And I was always obsessed with the 90s. Like, you can be like born in a time but not be an adult in that time, and I was like, that's how it is, and that's how it's gonna, that's how it was, that's what I miss, and that's what it's gonna be like when I'm a grown-up too. So that's why I just was like, this is dope.
I mean, it does feel so like of its time in a way that is like kind of fun and nostalgic, where I'm just like, you know, with these characters, it's so funny. It was what is the, I always forget the name of it, the Matthew Lillard movie about selling out, and it's about the man.
SLC Punk?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. SLC Punk, I feel like, is a more self-aware version of this storyline, where it's like very clear by looking at like, and also just like knowing how generations tend to pan out of like, half of these kids are going to be like Wall Street bankers and cause the recession, but this is their moment.
Corey's going to Harvard. Like,
right.
You know, like, no.
Yeah, it's not... Things are like not gonna, you know, and then, you know, AJ, or is that, yeah, like he's gonna like change to a business major one semester in, and they're gonna be the most boring people to ever live, and you know, whatever. No offense to business majors, except actually I don't think I actually think I offense to them.
Offense to business majors.
Like, what do you, you should have gone to art school like me.
Yeah, why didn't you get a master's degree in screenwriting? Hello.
Yeah, we're the moral authority of the fucking planet. Anyways, yeah, it's just, it's so 90s. And I mean, But so much of, like, you reference this in your piece, Shelley, of like how it seems like this story had really good bones, and those bones were just like repeatedly, like a crowbar was taken to the bones by like editors. And like, I was fascinated to find out that in the original draft of this movie, Corey was not trying to lose her virginity at all. She was just a big fan of Rex.
And I think what kind of like blew me with that too, like all the different changes that I could find. And also when I did interview Carol, I didn't want to interview her in a sense of being like, how did this end up this way? You feel me? I did, but I had so many of those questions that I wanted to ask, but she kind of just like let it out anyway and told me a lot of different things. But what was a big part of a lot of the changes to this movie, honestly, was Clueless. Like, there was already so many high school movies, either in production and post, being made, scripts had already been bought, that they were trying to like stand out in some way. And this is already a movie about a ragtag bunch of emo kids in, I don't know, East Jesus Nowhere, Seattle. Like, and they couldn't figure out what to do with it. And so they cut it up, they tore it apart. And then what I think they tried to bring it back on was the music. Because who would watch this movie, right? The kids that think they hear certain songs first, the kids that think that they're the only one who knows like one band and things like that. But even that couldn't save it at the box office.
Yeah.
It had to wait years for us to find it, or for me, and to be like, this is the most important movie of all time. So,
Well, I'm also interested to hear more about something you talk a lot about in your piece, which was published in Marie Claire, entitled Empire Records Helped Me Understand My Queerness. And you cite the friendship between Gina and Corey. You kind of like, I don't know if it was like a shipping thing necessarily, but like you drew inspiration from that in terms of like that powerful friendship. And that was sort of like the basis of what you were kind of looking for in romantic relationships. And just I'd love to hear you speak more about that.
Yeah, no, it was, because like when I was watching at that time, this is like middle school, and like all of us, right, had a shitty time in middle school. But I always say like my middle school experience was fucking terrible, right? And I was ready to get out. But you're in sixth grade, you have two more years left, you know? You're like, but the only way out was through movies like this and the teen movies that I would watch about high school, because I would be like, this is what's coming next for me. And this isn't only what's going to come next to me with friends. Maybe this is what comes next for me for like romantic kind of shit too, you know? But I was never really attaching. I wasn't looking for queerness in this film. I was just looking. I loved watching movies where girls were best friends, because like I didn't have really like a best friend that was just like that close, you know? And then when I started to grow up and I went to college and stuff like that, I learned about the lesbian or queer girl trope, where they're like, all lesbians or queer girls like end up falling in love with their best friend. You know what I mean? Whether it's reciprocated or not. And I had never fallen in love with any friend except for one girl in like elementary school, where I realized that I was queer. But when I was watching this specific movie, this was the first one where the two best friends had like a hella falling out. And it made me really sad, because I thought they were never, I thought it wasn't going to get back together. And I thought they weren't going to have a friendship anymore, which for me was breaking down my little cute world of what friendship is and what queerness could be with another girl. Because in Clueless, they were always best friends. In Jawbreaker, they didn't like each other from me to begin with. And then like in Can't Hardly Wait, that was an unrequited love, but it was between a cis male and then a cis girl and stuff. So this was the only movie where I saw two outcasts essentially be best friends and then fall out and then come back together in a stronger way. And that's all I thought I wanted in friendships, and then eventually relationships when I grew up. So I found queerness in it, even though that wasn't a queer relationship at all. But at the heart of so many queer girl relationships is friendship. So that's how I connected queerness to it.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's what's really cool about a movie like this, where, again, even if I'm like dragging it from a screenwriting point of view, like you can still like latch on to really meaningful things like that. And yeah. And clearly so many people have because of this movie's like cult fan base and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's just like a wonderful thing. And I'll try to stop making fun of its lack of three act structure.
No, please don't. The film is chaotic and crazy and unorganized and all this, but there was just so many things that I found in it, like from a screenwriting standpoint of view, from a culture critic point of view. Like, even if I was watching this movie and trying to take my personal feelings out of it, would I rip it apart? No, but I would not be giving it 4 stars on Letterboxd like I do now. Most of those stars are because I loved it, you know?
Yeah.
Also, another good thing that I saw in this movie that I connected with was a character we lost a lot of. Gina with her,
Deborah.
Yeah. And she was clearly like cutting, right? Because she talks about it with like a Lady Bic and stuff. And at that time in my life, I was also self-harming, you know, when I was doing it. So I was seeing, I saw that, something I hadn't seen in a movie that had a happy ending, you know, essentially, like, but a happy ending that was so true to the character, like that character having that funeral and stuff. It wasn't like outlandish. It was one of the only things that kind of made sense a little bit. But when I saw that, I thought that was cool because I was just like, damn, she's like going through something. She's not telling everybody about it. She's private. She's cutting. Her wrist is messed up. But then she's like, all right, I want these girls to be best friends again. So I'm going to put myself and my shit on the table and hope they do too. And then they did. And then they'd be friends again. And that was another thing that made me be like, I don't care that this record store costs only $9,000. This movie is incredible.
That whole, I want to like get into that like nest of relationships between the girls in this movie or the women. I don't know how old they are. I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
These young adults. But the Gina Corey stuff, it's again, it's like, I feel like you almost have to like headcanon your way through it a little bit, but I don't know. I was able to get there, and having a friendship like that, that, I mean, the slut shaminess was very true to that time. And while I would have liked to see more like apologies of like, I shouldn't have talked about you like that, that, like that was me being, because it's clear they're projecting onto each other in a way that it's like, just talk it out, like
just have a conversation.
Yeah, because Corey is feeling insecure about, like, she thought she was ready to lose her virginity, and then it, like, she had this traumatic experience, and she's like, I'm not. But instead of talking that out, she is projecting onto her friend, who she is jealous of, and is like, well, you have sex all the time, and you're a slut. And then Renee Zellweger, I mean, she, I appreciated how Gina was like, fuck you, like, you can't talk to me like that.
I did too. Like,
that was a cool moment.
Yeah.
And then Deborah, I struggled with similar stuff as well. And like, I wish that it's, and you're given these nuggets of like, oh, there was a real story in here at one point.
There was so much there. Yeah.
Because it's like, you get the smallest bit of context of, because it's like, we talk about this on the show all the time of like, why are women randomly turned against each other? Which I think in this movie, it kind of comes off a little like they're randomly turned against each other because of how much is cut out. But it seems like there was enough context at one point. In the final draft, not really, but you have that one scene with Deborah and Joe where Deborah's doing Joe's taxes. And like, I was like, I don't
quarterly
know.
Quarterly taxes, yeah.
Yeah.
She's literally doing the taxes in like the recording little phone booth thing. Like, why can't she go to the office?
I know. Why can't she be in that room where everyone,
the back
like,
room's full, actually. Yeah, that's true. Why. Too many people.
You can't focus on taxes.
Yeah.
But like, Joe goes in and Joe is daddy and he's like, I'm worried about you. Are you okay? Should I call your mom? And she says like, well, I can't find my mom. Like, she, it's implied that she has a very, very strained, possibly like abandonment related relationship with her mom, which would contextualize why she struggles to connect with other women.
Sure.
But you don't ever fully get there. And that would have worked for me too. It's like, if you had just been able to get there. And then there's an implication that like Gina has an issue with her mom too. It's only referenced once. And it seems like
the screenwriter like had a plan for how these relationships were going, like, and how these women were going to like resolve their issues and
connect. Like, yeah.
And it just like, I wish we had gotten to see it. I would love to see like a director's cut of this movie.
Hell yeah.
Does it exist?
Especially like I don't know. I think, did I ask that? Cause I was going to go back and watch, like, you know how you have the interviews and stuff, but so much gets cut out. Mm-hmm. But because I interviewed Hero through Zoom.
Yeah.
And I think I did ask that. And I think the answer to that is like, yes, but will we see it? Probably not. Mm-hmm. You feel me? But
yeah.
Because I think if we had gotten more story too, it would have, on her, it would have made sense as to why she was so helpful to her in the bathroom, to Liv Taylor in the bathroom. Because that was so personal and so like, sweet, but the way, like, if you didn't really pay attention to that character, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have been like, oh, that makes sense for her to do that. But I would like to see how they even got that, and also her situation with Berko, like, what was going on there, like,
right, there's like half context, because she's like, Deborah and Berko, who I always forget Berko is even a character, because he like shows up halfway through.
Is he wearing a wig?
I don't think so. I think it's just 1996.
Was that just really bad hair? I was like, is that what's going on his head? Like, I don't like it.
But I feel like it's implied that they have some kind of like romantic history, and he's like, are you okay? And she's like, what do you care? You didn't care last night. And then he's like, well, I don't know. And then she's like, you know, this isn't about you, but I thought about what happened last night and last week and last year, and I just,
and you're, I'd like, what, like, happened,
right? And we don't,
like,
know,
we're thinking about it too, like,
right. And then she just says like, but this is, I already told you, this isn't about you. And it's like, okay, but also like, what is the context of this relationship, and like, does that inform anything? And there's just like, isn't enough information given there, which I feel like is kind of a dangerous thing to do, especially when you're trying to talk about suicidal ideation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The movie's handling of that felt pretty irresponsible and like didn't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
And also like how they introduce her to the other two girls, like when they came to trade cash drawers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And she was like, shock me, shock me, shock me. But it's just like, why is she so hateful to these other two girls? Mm-hmm. Is it because they're so girly girl and she just happens to be like a punk kind of girl who just hates those kind of girly girls? Or is it like more than that? Or is that just how they're playing? I don't know. They put all the girls so against each other. Mm-hmm. And also with like Debbie Mazur's character too, low key a little bit, like how the girls saw her because she was hanging out with Rex and she was
right.
It just, they put everybody so against each other. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't paying attention at so much of that. I was always so focused on Corey and Gina, like throughout all of it, and they put them against each other too though.
Right
It's like they started united and then they were very abruptly torn apart. And like, again, I'm just like, I'm sure that there was a version of this where it made more sense. But I do, like, I agree with what you're saying as well, Caitlin, of like, when you're dealing with a narrative about self-harm, it's like, you have to have all of the context there or it becomes potentially harmful. And the cut of this movie that was released, like, it's not intentionally harmful, but it could come off as like a little bit romanticizing, like, alt girl who doesn't fit in does this. Because that was how, like, I mean, I think we've talked about this on the show before, but like, I learned how to self-harm from an episode of Degrassi, which I don't think was their intention at all. But it was like, that was something that was like, I wouldn't have known how to do that. And but when my favorite character on a TV show started doing, I was like, oh, that's something I can do. And then it like became a problem immediately. Like, it's just, you got to be real careful.
You have to be careful, especially also another way they kind of really should have explained a little bit more. Why was Liv Tyler's character so, I mean, I know they changed it. Obviously, she went to lose her virginity, but not really. But even like, why was she such a fan of this older man? Mm-hmm. And the way that she talked about her dad too, she was like, my dad pressures me and he just wants me to like go to Harvard and he wants me to do all my work. There's 24 usable hours in every day. Right. The way they made her talk about the older men in her life, but didn't really explain why she wanted to do that. It made it look like it was like romantic until he was like, I don't want to make love to you. You can definitely just suck my dick or whatever. Mm. But I really wanted, because for a second I was like, oh, that's, when I was watching when I was younger, I was like, that's kind of hot that she just like thinks this guy is so hot and she wants to like do all this stuff with him.
Because the movie frames it that way.
Yeah.
It frames it that way.
Oh my God. Yeah. The way the camera moves on Liv, and Liv Tyler is a teenager in this movie. Mm. And it's like
exactly
the
that
camera
too.
Movements on her air is really exploitative and gross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, leave this girl alone. Let's get her into the Lord of the Rings movies. Let's give her some sleeves. Let's let her live her life.
Get it going. Let's get her out of here. Let's get her, keep the crop top, but let's get her into Lord of the Rings. Like,
It's, and I would say the same thing with, and it's so abrupt that I think that the Deborah, the issue of self-harm was a bigger red flag to me, but the way that Liv Tyler's character's addiction storyline is dealt with very abruptly was also, I mean, it's like that one was so clearly half-baked in the way it's presented in the movie that I was like, we barely had time to deal with it. But it's like, she's not really offered any resolution in that. Like, it's, you're told very abruptly she is addicted to, it seems like Adderall.
Yeah.
Or like a speed, like
some kind of stimulant.
Yeah. Stimulant some kind drug. Of speed. Yeah.
And then she is outed by her friend, another traumatic thing. Mm-hmm. She has like a small like fit or like a break. She panics and she like lashes out. And then she gets a boyfriend. And I'm like, this doesn't
Like heterosexuality saves her or something. Like
what are we going to do about the addiction stuff?
Mm-hmm. Well, when she goes to Harvard, he's going to take care of her because he'll be really close by. So he'll definitely just take care of her and take care of everything, and she doesn't have to worry about anything, and she'll be okay because now she's in love with this boy. But her friend was the one who saved her. Well, not saved her, but not even her friend was the one who saved her. It was another girl who helped her,
who used to hate her, but then
but then you got on the rooftop and everything's fine. But also what I kind of, another thing that I kind of think was good, don't quote me. It's a podcast. You have to. But it'll be out here forever and ever. But another thing that I kind of thought that the movie kind of did a bit right was, and I mean light, right, was Renee Zellweger kind of being like, yeah, I love sex. I am this girl. Because she didn't apologize a lot for it.
Right.
She did. She should not have like done that to like get back at her friend and stuff like that. But it didn't seem like she had an issue being a sexual, cool person. And I think she was of age. I think. We don't know.
I think it's implied that she's a little bit older than that. And I don't even know why I think that. But I
I think they just wanted to make it clear that she's at least 18 when she was fucking like Rex Manning. I think that's why they didn't have her talk a lot about school and stuff. But I kind of dig that they were just having her like not be apologetic for it. She didn't want to be like her mom. So I'm assuming that was coming from like the job aspect of it. And maybe just like it was with sex too, some of it, but she didn't seem to have an issue with it. And I kind of thought that was kind of cool. A little bit, not like hella a lot, but it was kind of cool.
Yeah, it seems that it's far more the other characters who shame her for her,
who have an issue with it.
Yeah, than the movie itself.
Right.
Having any issue with like her being a sexually liberated person who's interested.
90s girl.
Right. So yeah, that I thought that was interesting too.
It's so, but then it's like, again, the movie, you can just like see the studio notes happening in the last 10 minutes of the movie, because she kind of doubles back on that at the end, where she like enters the funeral and is like, no, I'm not a cool sexually liberated girl. This is actually, I'm going to be just like my mother. And we don't know what that means, because we know nothing about Gina's family. We're like, that could mean anything.
Yeah.
And so she kind of like, I feel like she was like holding her ground the whole movie of like, how fucking dare you shame me? And then at the end, she's like, but really, I'm just having sex because I'm afraid to be a singer. And I'm like, you can be a singer who has sex. Like,
you can be a singer.
Why is it like
who
this
has sex?
Weird binary of like, blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah.
But I did, that said, I did love that Liv Tyler line read where it was such, like, there's just like, there's a few of these lines that I just, they're so teen movie in a way that really warms my heart, no matter if I know what's going on or not, where like Liv Tyler's like,
you're not going to be like your mother if you don't want to be like your mother. And I'm like, oh, I wish that was true. but what a 17, what an 18-year-old thing to be sure of, to say, be like, yeah. I don't want to be like my mom. So I'm not going to be. I'm like, that's just not how generational trauma works, but go off.
Yeah,
it's messy.
I think it's like, it's a very messy show or a film, but I just feel like there was, maybe that's another reason why I'm so attached to it, because I feel like there's a cut where there's reasoning behind some of it. And it doesn't, I think it leaves all the actual like connections on the cutting room floor. And I think if we had a chance to pile those up, and if the studio and stuff wasn't so scared about, oh, here's just another teen movie with another girl, like nowadays, I don't think they would have given a fuck. They would have been like, there's another movie coming out that's exactly the same as this, but we're going to put it out anyway.
Right.
But they did it, you know? They were just, like, too scared.
And I bet it would have done well.
It would have done well, yeah.
I really liked this. There's, like, an anecdote about how the executive who like bought Empire Records, because there was like, which is always exciting, especially for a female screenwriter, there was like a kind of like a small bidding war over the Empire Records original script, mm-hmm. which I would really love to read. I want to know how this movie was supposed to go, because
mm-hmm. yeah.
it was less about capitalism and virginity in the first one. It was all about like found, you know, chosen family,
yeah.
which I love. But there was the executive who like bought it and like greenlit Empire Records was then the next day approached with the script for Clueless. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I don't need Clueless. I already have a teen movie. And I'm like, oh, you fumbled so hard. What an L. That's so embarrassing. That he's like, I don't need it. I have a hit on my hands. And I'm like,
I already have Liv Tyler and Renee Zellweger. I don't know who they really are yet, but I'm doing this one instead.
I mean, I see where he was going with that, yeah. but he was wrong.
He was incorrect.
Yeah.
Especially because Clueless was such a like surprise box office hit. And
in itself, yeah.
Empire Records had a $10 million budget and only grossed like $300,000 or something like that.
Oh, but it was because the studio killed it. Yeah. It wasn't because people mm-hmm. didn't want to see it. It's because the studio made it impossible for people to see, because they fucked it up so hard
yeah.
that they then had to kill it themselves. And it's like, and everyone lost as a result.
Because Carol was also telling me like they started pulling theaters. Like they were just uh-huh. like, okay, well, maybe not here. Maybe. And then the run was also very short. I think it was only in theaters for like maybe a month.
2 weeks or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And in such a small amount of theaters, they didn't even give it a chance. They just,
yeah.
And then, yeah, they just so happened to like later it be like this like big hit or whatever with like the people who it really wasn't meant for. But at the mm-hmm. time, yeah, they killed it. Yeah.
Fucked. I don't like it.
Yeah. Because there is a really cool, coherent movie here. It's just yeah. not the one that it's ends up here. On the screen.
It's not the one on the screen.
But like there's so much potential for a movie to be about what it's about, which again is like misfits coming together as this chosen family, having issues, resolving those issues, like finding ways to bond, all that stuff that is like very mm-hmm. emotionally compelling and extremely relatable and human. It's just that it's so bogged down by so many weird, random, like tonally incongruous like scenes here and there mm-hmm. and just other kind of weirdness. And I feel like characters being rewritten to make weird choices, or things like suicidality and like drug addiction not being handled well. I mean, the overall cultural emotional intelligence of the mid-90s was like,
yeah,
not equipped to deal with this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but
I appreciate that they were trying.
They tried, and there's a lot of potential in this premise. I mean, again, from a teenager's watching this in the mid to late 90s and like finding so much to latch onto, like that is very cool, and I can understand why. And I'm sure I would have if I had seen this as a like
I would have loved
tween in like 98 or something like that.
Exactly.
Like I would have had a different response, but it's just I understand that like seeing it for the first time 4 days ago as a 35-year-old person living in 2022.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easier to criticize from that vantage point.
Yeah.
We got to take a quick break, but we will come right back.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Does anyone have any other thoughts about the movie?
I just think, like, on top of that, I just think it's, we have so much to talk about the relationship between the girls. And then with the guys, I'm just like, sometimes I forgot which guy was which. I'm like, these are all the same goofball. There's no conflict between, except between, like, daddy and son. Like, that's the only real, but, like, there's no frick, there's only universal support between these goofy boys. Like, they're all just like, oh, you're fucking wild, man. Like, in a way that it's like, it's goofy because they should maybe be in conflict a little more with each other. Mm-hmm. But also it just is like such a stark contrast to like the women in this movie are constantly in conflict, only in conflict, really. And then the guys are just like, yeah, whatever, man. Like, like it's so stark. It was just like bizarre.
Which is complicated because it's like the implication being women being in the same space together. Well, they're obviously going to hate each other and fight and have conflict.
Yeah.
But then it also means that those are the far more interesting and nuanced relationships in this movie. Whereas like all the relationships with the men are just like, who are you again?
Who is this?
They just want to smoke. They want to eat pizza. They bring each other snacks. And they don't. And that's the weird thing, because the biggest conflict is he stole $9,000 from him. But
that doesn't even create conflict in the story.
Yeah. It's what's to fight about is the fact that I want to lose my virginity to this guy. And for some reason, we're going to fight about it on our break at this really cute little cafe. Weird. Yeah, it's weird. It's weird.
And they're fighting over a disgusting creep who wants to do sexual things with a high school student. So absolutely fuck that guy. And then also, real quick, the Rex Manning fan base thing. So obviously he's resentful that only women over the age of 35, who he doesn't deem to be quote unquote fuckable, they're not sexually viable to him, they are the main demographic of his fan base, and he hates that that's who likes his music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene where Jane is talking about how Rex Manning's music tested well with teen boys, actually. And then Lucas says something like, oh, well, did you compare the teen boys who like Rex Manning's music to the incidence of homosexuality among teen boys?
Mm-hmm. So fucking 90s homophobic.
Yeah.
And that's ridiculous. But also, I feel like the movie is saying the fact that older women and gay men, that's who likes this guy, and that is part of why we're not supposed to like Rex Manning as a character.
For sure.
And it's look, older women and gay men have a lot of disposable income, and put some respect. And
good taste.
Yeah.
And good taste.
They're paying your rent. He just didn't care, because I think the main point of it that they wanted us to take away was the fact that he didn't see them as fuckable. Which is, again, another trope of being older women or whatever are no longer hot after, 25 or something that. And he's just after that, even though that is his whole fan base, is literally when you looked at the line outside, those were the people that showed up. And we would have I don't think that's why I wanted more understanding of why Liv Tyler loved him so much. She didn't fit it. Right. And I think we would have knew that if we would have talked about more about the stuff with her dad, because she clearly had issues with him, but we didn't. They skipped over all of that. Yeah, it was weird. It was weird.
It's very bizarre. This movie is just so weird. I don't know. Does anyone else have any other stuff?
I just don't understand why Lucas didn't clearly explain to Joe or anyone else what his intentions were with taking the money. He could have just been I saw that we were in trouble and I tried to save us, but oops, I lost all the money gambling. I'm so sorry. But he never says that every
Lucas
time.
Lucas only provides exposition to himself. He doesn't provide it to other characters.
And he came back with a bunch of quarters instead.
I know.
Which just get glued to the floor.
For the sake of art.
For art. Oh, gosh. But every time he tries to explain why he did what he did, it's just so metaphorical and cryptic. And it's your intentions were pure. You can just tell them what your intentions were.
Right. You were trying to help daddy.
You wanted to help.
Say that, but he can't. He's an agent of chaos. Lucas is such an annoying character, but I couldn't help but love him. I'm his heart's in the right place, but he just will not say the right thing at the right time ever.
At the right time.
What a sweetie. What a weird kid.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a little glimpse into his past too, that I assume was originally a bigger part of the story, where it sounds
he was put in foster care.
He took him in. Yeah.
Right.
He took him in, daddy. So daddy can't punish the kid all he took in. Yeah.
Right. Because he's I got this kid out of a bad situation. I'm not going to put him back into one.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just movie wise, it would have been nice to have that scene and get Lucas to communicate at some point in the movie, but he just kind of never does
about what's going on.
And then at the end he's daddy, I'm happy for you, and he's thanks, son.
Yeah, but instead of any of that further context or development that we needed, instead we get a scene where Mark is dusting near a woman who's just jamming out. She's closing her eyes. God. She's listening to the music, and then he tries to assault her. Like, he's just trying to kiss her.
Yeah.
And the movie plays it off as, isn't this funny and quirky and cute? Isn't that a funny thing for Mark to do?
Cut Mark from the movie, honestly. Like, that's the character that is most goable. Why didn't they cut Mark? They cut three people. They didn't cut Mark. Come on. This is unrelated, but just like, in a post-pandemic era, not that you could even get COVID from a pair of those headphones, but I was like, oh, that's so gross that we used to do that. Uh-huh. That we used to just
go to record stores and put,
It's so nasty. Why? God, wipe us out. Like, it's just like, nasty. Anyways, I think that that's my last comment is those headphones are so gross you couldn't pay me to put them on.
My last comment is at the very beginning when Lucas goes to Atlantic City and gambles. And the first time he's playing craps, right? And he doubles his money, or he wins money the first time.
He wins, yeah.
And then the like sexy lady that's next to him is like, you know, kind of cuddled up against him. And then she's like, you are sex, is a thing that she says to him. You are sex.
Like, I don't know about that, but go off. Oh, it's so funny.
I know exactly about that. Yeah, so that was amazing. And you are sex. We're all sex.
We're all sex, especially Gina, apparently. That's what they wanted us to.
Especially, right?
Yeah.
But how does she feel about it? We'll never know.
We'll never know.
Does this movie pass the Bechdel test? Huh?
Yeah.
Not a lot, right? Though. Yeah, but like not as much as you would think.
I was going to say.
Yeah, I think my favorite exchange is when Deborah says, hey, Miss Teen America, here's a button I made for you. Don't worry, I didn't spit on it.
Yeah.
And then Corey reads what it says and it just says dishonesty. So she's like, dishonesty? And that passes the Bechdel test.
There's a lot of sinister, there's a lot of sinister passes in this movie, but it does pass.
Which I accept. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. Sure. And I didn't know. That's the one I choose to like, that one that looks dishonesty. And it's like, well, we passed. So
we did it. Ladies, we did it. Feminist win.
Feminism.
Oh, gosh. And then as far as our nipple scale on we rate the movie 0 to 5 nipples based on examining it through an intersectional feminist lens. I guess my takeaway from this is that I appreciate that so many people have been able to latch on to this movie for its relatable premise of like misfits being represented on screen, finding a community, finding a chosen family, because not many movies were about that, especially in this era. So I understand why it was so appealing to people who had so little representation. That said, the movie is extremely white. It is extremely hetero. It is extremely like middle class, even though some of these characters, like it's suggested that a lot of the characters are struggling financially. We don't actually
see
any manifestations of that. It's just like, because we just see them one day in a record store and we're just kind of assuming, everyone's fine. So it's just, it only represents a very small demographic of people. It leaves a lot of people out. It does not handle a lot of serious topics such as suicidal ideation and addiction. Mm-hmm. Does not know how to approach handling those things, executes those things not well. But it's extremely valid for, you know, the people who saw themselves represented in the movie. And like, well, like you were talking about, Shelley, like even though there's no explicit queerness, even though, you know, you're still able to see yourself in it and see parts of like what you long for in it. And like, that's extremely valid. And with all of that in mind, I will give the movie 2 nipples.
Whoa.
Maybe is that too many?
Wait, I thought you were going to go lower than that. I'll wait till Jamie.
I thought I was 2.
Jamie's like, I got you. Okay, I love it.
I do like that a lot of the most interesting relationships in the movie are among women, and a lot of the most interesting arcs are afforded to the female characters. There's still a lot of tropes present there.
Yeah.
But what are you expecting from 1995, I guess? I think this is maybe too high. And did I enjoy watching this movie from a 0 to 5 scale? I would give this movie 0 nipples. But sorry. But from a, you know, is it doing some interesting things? Sure, I guess.
Yeah.
2 nipples.
Fair.
And I'll give 1 to Liv Tyler's crop top, and I'll give 1 to the line of dialogue, "You are sex."
Ooh.
Fair.
I'm going to do something weird here, and I'm going to give a nipple rating to the actual movie and a nipple rating to the movie that I think it was going to be prior to being released.
Okay.
Yeah.
The actual movie, I'm going to give 1 nipple to, because it's so messy, and it's like, there are the like seeds of so many interesting things, but because of the way the movie was edited and marketed and rewritten outside of like the writer's original vision, I feel like it does miss the mark a lot of the time. And I like totally echo, I mean, the 90s, like extreme, you know, white middle class heterosexuality, which is true of basically the whole genre at this time.
Yeah.
But even on top of that, like, I would say I had a 5 out of 5 nipple experience watching this movie, because you were just like, I was paying such close attention, waiting for something to make sense. And like, it was so fun to be like, huh? What? He's got a gun? Like, what is happening? So viewing experience was incredible. It's always like, you know, kind of disappointing in a way, again, that it's like not the writer or the director's fault to see a teen movie try to approach serious issues that could have been impactful if they had been given some room to breathe, and then see a kind of undercut. So I'll give 1 nipple to the movie that came out, and I'll give that to Liv Tyler's crop top. I'm going to give 3 nipples to the movie that I like think was in there, maybe even 3.5. Mm-hmm. Like, if you had gotten like Deborah's, you know, full backstory and like gotten to fully realize a self-harm narrative that had a positive ending for the character in a teen movie, I think that could have been a really cool, impactful storyline if it was done thoughtfully. Same goes for the Liv Tyler storyline. Same goes for the slut shaming storyline with Gina. Like, like Carol was saying in her interview with you, Shelley, like, it sounds like the Gina Corey friendship was so much more integral to the movie she wanted to make.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to have seen that. So I'll give 3.5 to the movie that I think it was at one point. And I'll give those nipples to You Are Sex. I'll give them to the dirty headphones. I'll give them to the newscaster who's like, the news is on live. And I'm like, yeah, we know. And I'll give my last half to the eyebrows.
Oh, Debbie Mazur.
Debbie Mazur's eyebrows.
Yeah.
I think, like, with everything that y'all were saying about, you know, the cisness, the whiteness, everything a part of it, putting all that in and also taking all of that apart and being like, yeah, there was more here than meets the eye, or that's on the cutting room floor somewhere or in someone's basement. And rating the movie that we actually got, I would definitely just give it like 2 stars. And sorry, 2 nipples. What am I on? Letterboxd? I'm sorry.
Shrekky, how could you?
Shrekky? Cut it out. Sorry. That wasn't me, actually. That was Shrekky that said stars. I apologize. Yeah.
Shrekky just came out in that moment.
I would give it 2 nipples. And the 1 nipple, of course, goes to Liv Tyler's crop top. Like, that will forever get 1. And the other one, I think, goes for, like, what it was trying to do. Like, everything that it was trying to do, what it could have been, all the holes in the story and stuff like that, because I think they're saying something if you can not only find the holes in the story, but then be like, oh, there's more to this. I think if your mind when you're watching it is like, instead of just being like, oh, that doesn't make sense, and then throwing it aside, if instead when you're watching a movie and you're like, wait a minute, there was something actually there and something just got fucked up, then you can be like, you can appreciate it a little bit more. So that's what my nipple rating scale is. But in a universe where none of this happened and I'm in middle school and I'm watching this movie that was not meant for this like black girl, Midwest, middle class, like weirdo, I'm gonna give it like 5 because it made me fucking happy. Yeah. Like it made me happy. Hell yeah. It made me happy and I made memories with it. I danced around my room to it. I would like act it out in certain scenes when I would watch it different times. Like,
I love it.
And then I got to like write about it for its 25th year anniversary and stuff and talk to the person who made it. So for that, I give it 5 in that world. But that's it. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm so good. Thank you for bringing us this movie because it really was
of
like,
of course, thank
just
you.
A fun wormhole. This is like one of my favorite chaos conversations on the show in some time. It's so fun.
Yay. Awesome.
Truly. Yeah. Come back anytime.
Oh my God.
Bring
any I will.
Movie you want. And tell us where people can follow you on social media, read your writing, anything else you want to plug.
Well, if you just type in Shrekky on Twitter, you'll find me. If you just type that in, you'll find me. It's totally fine. No, I'm mostly on Twitter at Hi Shelly. And then I'm on Instagram at Ayo Shelly. On Twitter, I just talk a lot of shit about movies and TV that I want people to watch that I think they should be watching.
Nice.
And on Instagram, I just post cute pictures of myself. But yeah, and then I write culture writer at Autostraddle, and I write, you know, a lot of pieces there. But I also just edit a lot of really dope new and emerging writers over there too, especially Black and Brown queer writers. And then other than that, I write at a few other places. I just be anybody that wants to let me talk about a movie and pay me for it. I pretty much do it, so I'm there.
You're real good at it. Please keep doing it.
Thank you. <Yeah. laughs> Thank you. But that's it.
Truly come back anytime.
Yes.
Oh, dope. I love you guys. This is such a dope podcast. I remember when I found it, and I really dig it ever since. And yeah, it's just dope.
Thank you so much. Oh, we're listening. So happy you could come on.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess you can follow us on social media, Twitter and Instagram at BechdelCast. We've got our Patreon, aka Matreon, that gets you 2 bonus episodes every single month. It's $5 a month, and you can hear such episodes as the Stuart Little one, where Steve Zahn, who again should be in this movie, says, "You're my best friend, Snowball."
How about you, my best friend? They're man, some of my favorite Matreons are like, you'd think there's nothing to talk about in Stuart Little, but there's a whole Gina Davis feminism conversation to be had. So that's where if you want more chaos, you can also get our merch at tpublic.com/thebechdelcast if you're so inclined. Follow us on Instagram, follow us on Twitter, or don't. All right? Or don't.
Or do.
Or do.
Also, give us 5 nipples on Apple Podcasts or whatever.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, because people were getting really mad about the Zootopia Hive came for our comment section on Apple Podcasts. So if you could help out there, that would actually rock, because I didn't realize how much people love animal cops. Anyways.
All right. Well, yikes. That concludes Rex Manning Day on the BechdelCast. Let's close up. It's midnight, so we gotta go.
Time for the fundraiser. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old rich man, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart for a year, and what a year it has been. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Make Woke AF Daily your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.